The following is a podcast of a conversation Tim O'Reilly had with Mozilla Foundation President Mitchell Baker and Sun President and COO Jonathan Schwartz at the Web 2.0 conference in San Francisco in October 2005. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and this podcast is brought to you by Make Magazine, technology on your time. In Volume 4 of Make Magazine, cool holiday kits, build a cigar box guitar, circuit bending, high-speed flash photography, coffee hacks, and lots of cool DIY music projects. Now, here's Web 2.0 Conference Chair, John Battelle.
We're going to start with Tim O'Reilly and Mitchell Baker of the Mozilla Foundation, and then Jonathan Schwartz is going to be joining us shortly. I think he's like stuck in an elevator or something like that. But he'll be down. I'm sure he's just coming off the high of the Google Sun announcement. That was a lame joke, wasn't it? But to start this conversation is Tim O'Reilly, my co-program chair. And he'll bring up the rest of the conversants. Tim? Hey. Yeah, we're running early for a change, exactly.
Hey, I want to start out...
Hey, Mitchell.
Hey, Mitchell, why don't you have a seat, I don't know, somewhere in
right
the middle.
Computer, huh?
And I'll sit over here. We had said in the program that the title of this session was Can Open Source Stay Open? And that's actually a bit of a... misleading title. The real question that we want to ask and answer here is, what is the relationship of open source to this whole idea of Web 2.0? Those of you who read my What is Web 2.0 piece, found it a piece of wankery, probably don't want to read an earlier piece that I wrote, but if you thought there was some substance to it, you might want to look at a piece I wrote called The Open Source Paradigm Shift, which was really what led me to the idea of Web 2.0 and how all these things come together. And I want to just kind of start by asking, before I ask Mitchell any questions, and certainly before I ask Jonathan any questions, I want to start by asking you and the audience a question. That is, how many of you use Linux? Okay, pretty good showing. But now I want to ask you, how many of you use Google? Okay, that is the... issue that made me start thinking about the relationship between open source and Web 2.0. Because everybody in the open source community was arguing about what were the applications on Linux, you know, and they'd be saying, hey, you know, the GIMP is getting really good, or you should see the latest build of OpenOffice.org. And they were missing the fact that the killer apps on Linux were all these new breed of web-based applications, Google, Amazon, Yahoo runs on BSD. So this was really a pretty interesting question. So what we're really here to start exploring is this idea of how was open source one of the rivers that led into Web 2.0, and what role does it continue to play? So why don't we start by let me ask Mitchell a couple of questions. And, clearly the browser it has something to do with web. With the web. So of all of our open source projects... Oh, we got Jonathan? Well, let's... can we please have Jonathan Schwartz, President and COO of Sun Microsystems. Sorry, we jumped the gun on you here, Jonathan.
No, that's okay.
Great to have you. Thanks for coming.
So can we actually go back to one of the points you were making?
Sure.
So how many of you use Firefox?
Pretty good showing. You guys are all early adopters.
And how many of you use OpenOffice? And how many of you use Windows?
How many of you are on the Mac, just for the heck of it?
Yeah, there we go.
We're not a typical crowd.
No.
All right, good question. Well, actually, Jonathan, since you're here, can I switch and start by asking Jonathan a question here? A lot of people might say that you're late to the open source party. Yeah, obviously, other people will say, you guys are kidding. Sun was there first.
Yes.
And in fact, you guys were among the first to build a company by commercializing open source back when you were launched. But it seems to me that you have a fresh approach to open source. When you think about competing with Red Hat, I don't think you're thinking the way, say, Novell is thinking about competing. Can you talk Certainly. About how you think about open source and how it plays into your strategy?
Sure, and maybe I'll actually start getting back to one of the questions that we just asked. You really have to think about open source in two respects. And one of them is, can you raise your hand if you're a developer? And one of the ways you have to think about open source is the distribution of intellectual property. And I think that can't be underestimated, but let me assure you that just as a minority of you just raised your hand, there are a minority of users in the world that know what on earth to do with the Mozilla source tree.
Absolutely.
And so what matters more in the world, and I know I, you know, piss off some in the open source community when I say this, is the price of the software. Free software is what has massive power. Google is powerful, not because they're running on any one technology, but because their service is free. And so if you choose to focus on the code, you miss the massive phenomena that's taken over the world, which is the freedom with which you can access wonderful network services, some of which are like Firefox, a download that you actually have to put on your desktop or on your server or what have you. And some of them are the services you'll get through those products. But you can't simply look at it in terms of, okay, open source is a means of distributing code, and that in and of itself has value. Source code has no value in and of itself.
So how does that thinking play into Sun's strategy?
Well, we have to combine both the distribution of code with the delivery of services that people are going to want. And the price tag, you know, has a lot to do with it. You can reach a lot more people in the world with a free product than one that if you charge.
Right, but at the end of the day, Sun sells hardware, and Google...
No, that's not true. What we just announced yesterday had nothing to do with hardware, did it?
I understand, but it's a huge part of your business. And so you've got to figure out what that transition is from one business model to another.
You're presupposing that people bought the hardware for the hardware and not for what I claim they bought it for, which is they love Solaris.
Right, but...
Please,
for this
feel
way.
Free to applaud now. That's awesome.
When there was a time in the 90s when you could legitimately make the claim that Sun was the power behind the internet. And I think you can't make that claim anymore. I mean, Linux has really taken over.
You mean Red Hat?
No, I don't mean Red Hat.
I don't think
Google runs Red Hat.
I'm sorry, Google builds their own computers.
That's right.
I don't see a lot of customers doing that.
I think that you may be, you know, bucking a trend there. But we can agree to disagree, because the fact is...
How many of you build your own computers?
Yeah, how many use the services that run on computers that are built that way? That's the question, not how many people build their own. But let's not go there. I mean,
we should, Tim. I mean, this is the...
we might fight over that one. But Mitchell will get caught in the middle.
Just kind of like my standard here.
It seems to me that you do have a strategy that you've expressed in the past, which is buck a CPU hour,
yeah,
which is a consequence of thinking about delivering what you do as a service. How's that going?
It's interesting. As you would expect, there is a distribution of people who bond to the idea that paying for computing services actually makes sense for them. And so if I could, the spectrum goes from you're a big bank that does Monte Carlo simulations on your portfolio. You need tens of thousands of CPUs to go run these simulations. So having engaged with those folks, what you end up with is a 500-page contract that describes how you're going to build an air-gap network that is specific with their, you know, InfiniBand switches, and you just go down a rat hole. So our mistake was assuming that that was the belly of the market. Now, more interestingly, when we open this up to be a retail service, stay tuned, that's just around the corner. And by retail, I mean you're going to be able to go to a website, log in, take your PayPal ID, and boom, go buy CPU hours.
Customer self-service, one
customer
of the key principles of Web 2.0.
And, which is a good thing. Sadly, the government would like to interject itself and claim if you're using more than one CPU, you're building a weapon.
Are you serious?
I am dead serious. but all that aside, that we had an interesting rush of demand, I think it was last week or the week before, from oil and gas companies in Texas. Why were they so eager? It's called Hurricane Rita.
All right.
And all of a sudden, there was no 500-page contract. There was just a, how do we get our work into that grid so we can get it done? And boom, we sold out the initial infrastructure.
Nice.
And so what I see happening is a couple things. One, the customers who are really getting over the cultural hurdle to self-service are going to get there quickly. But the majority of the market is going to be from a guy at Princeton University who's a protonomic modeler who just wants to get access to a ton of CPUs quickly, and he's got $5,000 in his budget, and he's going to spend it. That, to me, the long tail is going to be the majority of the revenue in the market, not figuring out a way to convince a investment bank that we want to customize a grid for them. That's called customization. That is not, you know, to me, the future of the internet.
Yeah, I believe in principle that you're right. I'll be really interested to figure out if the market does play out that way. I hope it does, because I think that is, in fact, you know, a viable future. I guess the question from an economic point of view, though, is, you know, how does the revenue from that stack up to your current revenue sources? I mean, this is a conversation we've had, you know, with a number of people here. Last night we were talking with Microsoft about, you know, these new forms of monetization. And the big question that, you know, the elephant in the closet for everybody is, does the new form of monetization, how does it stack up with the old one? And does it support the same cost structures? Does it support the same kind of company? Or does it support a different kind of company?
I think the economic opportunities are much, much more attractive in the next generation of the business than we've seen to date. And so my belief is, just from the modeling we've been doing, you know, the monetization opportunities around the grid, and by the way, we're not going to be the only ones who are going to deliver a grid. We're going to go sit down with the big telcos and have them deliver grid services as well. We'll surpass the margin and profit opportunities of figuring out a way to hawk a box and, you know, try to make 30 points of margin on it.
Right.
You know, there's another aspect to that, too, which is the actual cost of doing things. Right now, we take for granted the cost of control structure is very high, whether it's the 500-page contract and the whole infrastructure that's built up around having something centralized and needing to control it. It's the same with open source and, I think, with Web 2.0. And one of the things that I don't think we've really explored yet are, what are the actual savings with self-service in an infrastructure level? So I think, looking back in 5 or 10 or 20 years, it may well be that we look at the model we take for granted 5 years ago of proprietary software. Each copy is licensed. We make a whole new law so that shrink wrap licenses are enforceable. We worry about piracy. We have this giant infrastructure that's all based on a center trying to control. And I think that as that begins to change to customer self-service, people being able to actually do more things, that the cost of enforcing control will become, we'll see how prohibitive and what a drain it is in the current system. So I think there's some expense savings that we haven't begun to understand yet.
Right. You bring up a really interesting point, and this was not the initial question I was going to ask you, but definitely one I wanted to go to. One of the benefits of open source is it does lower the friction, it does lower the cost of coordination, it does lower the barriers to entry of people who just want to do things with your stuff. You know, it's another version of what Jonathan is saying is free, even though there aren't, maybe everybody isn't a developer. For a developer, free is, wow, I can do this without having to make a deal with somebody, I can just do it.
Right.
And you were talking before we came in about, you know, the locus of innovation and where innovation happens. So tell us how that plays into your thinking, you know, with Firefox.
So there's a sort of long history of innovation and cycles of innovation in the browser and client space. But what we've tried to do with Firefox and what we're seeing now is the combination of sort of open, first of all, free, but available, and the ability to look and change and try things out is a phenomenal driver of innovation. So not only is Firefox there, so you can assume it's there, but of course you can look at it and you can, our goal is to make things easy to change.
Right.
So what is it that's really going to work? Right, so for example, we've all seen Grease Monkey, but what are the actual scripts that people are going to want? Well, we need to try that out. So Firefox, the idea is that it's easy to try things out. You can try things out quickly. We can try 5 or 10 or 20 different things, see what works. And the we isn't actually us, right? I mean, the we is the whole set of people out there. So we have a whole community of what I would call user-generated data, you know, right, in your meme, which is generated about how I use the web, what I'm interested in doing, what bothers me, what I might want to do. And so the effect of having an open platform, if everyone wants to use that word, but if you think of Firefox as an open platform, is to open up those possibilities and allow them to be tried out.
Right? So if you were to contrast the last set of browser wars between Netscape and Microsoft, it was all about feature leapfrog, which had some negative effects in terms of user experience. But you've got a trump card that Netscape didn't have, and that trump card is that the users can add features. You know, people can't add something. They can't change Internet Explorer in the same way they can change Firefox.
Right.
And you've basically got an architecture.
Well, so, I think of it as our trump card is the web. I mean, why is Firefox exciting? Yes, it's a nice product, when you go to use the web. But the trump card is the power of the web and the set of things that people can do with it.
Right.
So, yes, people can change Firefox. But the average person, as you pointed out, isn't going to change Firefox. But the possibilities of groups of people figuring out things and trying out different distributions and being able to try it in markets and see what works and come back. It's not just changing the code, right? There is the ability to change the code, but there's ease of distribution, ease of trying things out. So if I could, in your Web 2.0 paper, you talk about websites that will try a set of features on a few pages and see if users like it, and the ones that work well get adopted in general. Firefox is that same meme.
Right. So coming back to this idea of extensibility, and you mentioned GreaseMonkey. It seems to me GreaseMonkey brings up a really interesting set of issues about who's in charge of user experience. We've talked in this conference about user experience being one of the key changes that we think of as Web 2.0. But with GreaseMonkey, the site is no longer in charge of the user experience. The user is, in a fairly radical way. I mean, do you see that taking hold, or is that just kind of like somebody pushing out ahead to prove a point?
I think a part of it will take hold. I don't see the full power of something like GreaseMonkey taking hold in the immediate future. Right, for the people in this room, maybe. But the other thing is, the average consumer right now is confused. The average consumer actually doesn't know the difference between their browser, the internet, and the search box.
Right.
We get that over and over and over again. Right. So for the average consumer to say who's in that setting, they actually don't really understand the difference between the website and the piece of software very well on their system, to say, okay, now you're going to make 15 different changes and it's all going to look different, is very confusing.
Right.
So I actually don't see the full power of GreaseMonkey really widely adopted in the general consumer base in the near future.
Yeah.
I do see, and so this is part of the job of what we try to look at, is to say, first of all, let's encourage GreaseMonkey. Let's encourage things like GreaseMonkey. Let's see what early adopters and power users and people who are really interested in playing with things like, let's abstract out the gem of that, and let's get the gem of that in the base so that moves out into the core. And, of course, when you do that, the hard part about the product, it's not just making something exciting and innovative that power users like. It's to take the gem of that idea and make it comfortable enough that the average consumer likes it, so it actually gets spread out and become a part of the platform.
Right.
So I think we'll see a piece of that, but only like a small portion of it in the core, and then the other pieces will be in extensions that various power users or even somewhat more sophisticated users can start to use.
So jumping to a completely different topic, I want to ask Jonathan about your announcement with Google recently. Now, a lot of us read the announcement, and we couldn't quite make head or tails out of exactly what was announced. There's indications of serious cooperation, but everybody was trying to read between the lines and see more in there than you actually said. So can you say what was in between those lines?
My bet is in this room everyone wanted us to announce we're going to do, an Ajax office suite.
Right.
And I'm not sure the world needs one.
Right.
We could implement Firefox in Ajax. It just wouldn't make any sense. I mean, you have Firefox.
Right.
We don't need to go, re-implement that. So, I think a few things, maybe touching on what Mitchell was saying. The power to me of open source isn't code. Code's a good thing. We need it. We all love it. Very few of us know how to modify it and, type make. The power is in the community. And it's in building a community that can contribute to the future success of a product. Firefox is successful because of the Firefox community, not because of the Firefox source tree. So yesterday, or the day before yesterday, you know, we talked about changing what would happen in the relationship between Sun and Google, beginning to recognize, to me, one of the most important things, which I don't think we have yet talked about, which is the power of distribution on the network. Because, by the way, the most popular products out on the network, you know, and I'll go through a few of them, Java, Google, Flash, OpenOffice, certainly. I mean, how many of those have source that's open source? Is Flash open source?
No,
but it's pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah.
The power is
it's
in
actually
the
more ubiquitous than Java, I believe.
On desktops, yes,
yeah.
I would agree.
Yeah.
But the power is in the distribution of the product. It's how many of them are out there. The fact that you can begin to create a community around it.
Yeah.
And so when you look at what happened in the relationship between Sun and Google, we did a couple things, and just go look at my blog and I'll give you more detail about it. The first thing we announced is that we're working together. In and of itself, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And because there's a lot we could do together. We got a lot of technology, they got a lot of distribution power. Second thing we announced is we're going to combine our distribution efforts, because Java's actually got tremendous distribution out into the marketplace and persistent distribution, somewhat unlike Flash. Java persists on your desktop, which means we can ask the 250 million installed base, would you like a new feature, like a toolbar, or maybe like a VoIP client, or like a let your mind run wild. Similarly, Google basically said, we're interested in distributing OpenOffice, and we will assist in the promotion of OpenOffice, which again, to the extent that distribution matters, is a huge push. It's a big piece of wind in the sails. And then finally, we alluded to Google's involved in the JCP, one of the largest communities on the internet to date, with more than 900 companies and individuals involved. And if you look out on the net today, you'll actually see some interesting extensions to OpenOffice. For example, a search feature built in that allows you, once you've emitted an ODF document, to kind of go search around, search other people's documents, and again, let your mind run wild for a moment. Why not store those documents, be able to edit them in a distributed fashion? There's all kinds of things we can do. Google tends to be a little bit more tight-lipped about the future than Sun. And so with respect to Google's plans, you should probably talk to them. But I just think there's a lot that can be done by powering and by combining distribution with technology. Firefox is interesting because it's so well distributed, not simply because it's a good browser.
A well-distributed, lousy product is not enough. But we've had a well-distributed, lousy IE for many years. So I agree with distribution, but I do want to say that the code or the product and the user experience and the quality of what you're out there distributing is important.
So let me amplify that. There's a really interesting court case, Cablevision versus the New York Yankees. And for those of you that don't know the story, it goes like this. Cablevision is the largest cable operator in the New York metro area. The Yankees, rumor has it, are a good sports team. And they wanted to get their ball games distributed to Cablevision's customers. And Cablevision said, that's great. We're going to charge $10 more for you to get access to Yankees games. And the Yankees said, no, we don't want to be premium content. We want to be available and affordable to everyone. And Cablevision said, well, while we're working this out, we're going to take the Yankees off the air. That's called the power of distribution.
Yeah.
So what happened was, everybody should go to MLB.com. The Yankees just leveraged the internet, and now MLB does an amazing job of broadcasting Yankees content to the world. But there's still a court case. Now, in our world, and I mean collectively our world, the power of the distribution in the marketplace has been by the folks who distributed the OS. Whatever they said goes is what went.
And what you're saying is the power of distribution is shifting.
It has totally shifted to quality, to value, to innovation, and to communities. That's what Firefox rides on, OpenOffice, Java, and Google, frankly.
Right. And that has been one of the greatest changes in the last year with Firefox, because one of the things people said, they said, A, you can't make something that complex that good in your small little open source project, and B, if you made it, no one would notice. Well, guess what? You know, we made it in Firefox, and people have noticed.
And Google noticed.
Yeah.
Well, Google did not go download that product 90 million times. Right? Somewhere around the world, 90 million times without any old-style distribution, no OS vendors, that many choices have been made to go get it. And that, so I'm actually agreeing,
but
the power of the distribution through the
web. Right, and that's one of our Web 2.0 principles, certainly. Right. If you have to advertise, it probably isn't Web 2.0. You know, I mean, the fact is, if people are not talking to each other about it, telling other people, try this, you're missing the boat
somehow.
It's the
power of communities.
Yeah.
Communities connect together, and they cause massive distribution.
Yeah, so coming back to this idea of the browser wars. We had a fairly destructive period in the 90s where, you know, user experience was damaged by, you know, kind of a long pissing match between Netscape and Microsoft. You know, well, we're going to have a feature that's different. Do we face a return to that? And if so, is that a real roadblock to, you know, all the good things that are starting to happen now?
Right. Well, a couple things. I mean, in the 90s, we had two problems. We had the Netscape-Microsoft fight and the new features, and then we had the Netscape demise, right? And then the stagnation with no new features and deterioration, right? So different kind of problem, easier for content developers to develop to one mediocre product, not easier for users who suddenly faced, you know, a deteriorating experience.
Right. So, and Microsoft has always risen to competition.
Yes.
They do their best work when they've got, you know, a threat.
Right.
And I think that's actually really one of the very nice things happening right now is, you know, a really great company is threatened on a bunch of fronts, and that means we're going to see some great stuff from them. And, you know, when they have no competition, they, you know, lapse into
poor.
You know,
right.
Boring.
So if I could kind of, yeah, say, well, it's not just Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
if you're the only one in the market and there's no competition and there's no need to innovate and it doesn't matter what you do,
yeah,
you probably put your resources somewhere else. So I think the second phase of difficulties in the 90s was totally predictable, you know, as a result of.
Right.
The
so the point is we've got two evils. So you can have hyper competition, which is destructive to the user, and you can have no competition.
Right.
Hopefully we can find the golden mean.
So where are we now? Well, first, just like maybe you're not going to speak for Google, you know, to speak for Microsoft would be like beyond me.
I'm perfectly happy to speak for Microsoft.
Right.
May not be, but I would be.
So we are as cognizant of anyone of the hyper competition and the need to avoid that. So in our thinking and in our role, we will do everything we can to avoid that. We also spend a fair amount of time thinking about, and this is another of the challenges of innovation, why it's not always possible to go flat out for the most innovation as quickly as possible. We spend an enormous amount of time thinking about if we add a new feature or a new capability, not necessarily an end-user-facing feature, but the infrastructure underneath it that ties to the web, what is the sort of natural fallback or degradation, what's the experience that an IE user would get?
Yeah.
Right? Because we recognize that to go out and add a lot of things in the core of the browser, you know, in our release that only works in IE and that, only works in Firefox and that an IE user, you know, it breaks or the site breaks is an experience that content and websites are not going to adopt or be happy with. So there is the question of how do you have graceful degradation and then, again, back to the extensibility and the extension mechanism, making those innovative things possible either for people who have particular targets or for whom this degradation piece isn't as important. Yeah. So that's actually an area where we spend an enormous amount of time. Now, does that mean Microsoft will do the right thing?
I think they may, but that's another story. Right. Jumping to a completely different topic. Jonathan, you mentioned your blog earlier. You're probably the most senior executive blogger of any major company out there on the net. What's your thinking behind that? Blogging takes a lot of time. Obviously, you think it's worth your time. What do you think the effects have been?
It takes a lot less time than one-on-one interviews.
So you're disintermediating the press, in other words.
I would never do that. That would be unfair. I guess there's an incredible power in community. And I think most folks that I know in the software world, and now by software world I'm talking about folks who type code and who care about the technology, understand that they make choices not based on economics but based on philosophies and beliefs. And as I've said before, developers don't buy things, they join things.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we call it the open source community, not the open source marketplace. It's the developer community, it's the Java community, the Firefox community. Communication
is a
critical element of creating community. It's very difficult to create community if you're going to kind of wall yourself off behind an office and, you know, hope the world gets where you're going. So for me, transparency is a competitive weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when IBM or Microsoft are out there spending, and I'm not joking, a half a billion to $1 billion a year on advertising, give me a break.
Let me ask this question. When you use your blog, you use the phrase transparency. Are you always transparent on your blog, or do you sometimes use it to mislead? Or to provoke, or to do other things?
Certainly to provoke.
Yeah.
And I am never unauthentic. Because the day I'm unauthentic, why bother reading the blog? There's plenty of other places to get unauthentic, you know.
Right. Well, I don't mean unauthentic, but, you know, there is the potential for misdirection by... I think about, for example, in my own blog, I am conscious of certain things where I say, if I say that, I will be feeding, you know, data directly to a competitor. So I choose what I'm going to talk about.
I'm very careful about what I say, and yeah. I'm also, you know, Section 16 officer of Sun Microsystems. So yeah. There's, as Mitchell knows, a good body of law around what I'm allowed to say and when I'm allowed to say it. But, you know, I certainly have caused a few coronaries in the Sun legal department. And they've been very quick to come back with, here's the 19 paragraphs of disclaimers and, you know, safe harbor provisions you need to put into your blog.
Do you actually do that? Or
yeah, I've had to in a couple instances. Uh-huh.
Do they read your blog before you post it?
No.
No. Okay.
So one of them would like to. He's called the general counsel, but... You know. He's got my cell number instead.
And the alert every time there's a posting in your blog. Exactly. Right?
RSS is a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I think it goes back to there's a transformation occurring on the web today, and I love the concept of Web 2.0. I would perhaps draw it a little more broadly. You know, HP just did something. They signed a deal with Netscape to distribute the Netscape browser. There's competition in the browser marketplace now.
Yeah.
That's an excellent thing. And does it degrade the user experience? I don't know. Does choice degrade your user experience? You know, choice for the most part. Look, how many Linux distros are in the world today? Hundreds? Is that bad for the world? I don't claim that's bad for the world. I think it's a good thing. I think it creates innovation and opportunity.
So I know I'm jumping all over the map here, but I've
had
a great chance to interview the two of you and ask questions that I've been wanting to ask. Mitchell, a bunch of the Firefox developers now work for Google. Has that changed their relationship to Firefox in any way?
Well, there have always been developers working for one company or another. I mean, they were all at Netscape at first, but there's a set of developers. There's also developers at Yahoo, and there's Mozilla or Firefox developers at a lot of different places. The Google folks tend to get the most press and the most notice. So a couple things happen. Those developers, I think, and their management have been very interested and very focused on maintaining their role in the core as it has always been. And that is excellent. So Google has been an excellent partner in these regards, and the developers there continue as before. Of course, they also have access to whatever's going on at Google. Right? And so their interests and thinking about Web 2.1, if they call it Web 2.0, but thinking about the set of services that might make sense in Firefox and how might you combine either Google's offerings or somebody else's offerings in a browser, and what's the combination between those that makes sense in the browser, they'll come at it with, A, a lot more information than they used to have, and B, of course, information primarily from one source, you know, what they're thinking about.
Right. So Google has a pretty strong information firewall with outsiders, though. Does that interfere at all with your planning, or are they ever kind of saying, well, we can't really tell you such and such, you know, that we're thinking, or is there ever a block there?
Well, so the rules of engagement on our end are, if it's in the browser, there's no block, mm-hmm. right? You need to make that decision to engage mm-hmm. with Firefox. Now, on the other side, if you're not ready to talk about it, there's a whole range of extension pieces, mm-hmm. right, where you're very welcome to do that if you want and not talk to us about it in a proprietary sense, and, you know, we'll see it when you post it.
Right.
But everyone... who's interested in working on something that affects the core and wants some changes or wants some set of discussion has to decide how much they'll talk about.
Yeah, I think this idea of the core and the extension mechanism, right. I think all really successful open source projects have that well-defined boundary, and I think that really helps solve that problem.
Yep.
But it is a kind of an interesting dynamic, I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, it is. Although we do have some history in it, it turns out actually that in the engineering sense, it's
historically been much easier for companies to allow information to flow at the engineering sense. And maybe this is back to your point that code isn't everything. So we've always actually had pretty good luck and a pretty good flow of information in among the engineers about what needs to happen that if you spent enough time and energy thinking, you could maybe devise some business or marketing or product plan out of it. So that level turns out for most companies to be relatively easy. It's when you get into the product marketing and here's our release date and here's the actual functionality of the extension we want to build on it.
So we should take some questions from the audience. So if people have questions for either Jonathan or Mitchell, you should come up to the mics and
maybe extra points if it's for both of us.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the points that Mitchell just made, though, and one of the points I'd argue that's kind of vital to the success of any community is governance. Mm-hmm. And it's how you go about making those decisions that the transparency of those decisions has a big impact on the integrity of those decisions and how the community feels about itself and what prevents it from fracturing. Mm-hmm. And so through the Java community process, it's a very, very well-defined governance model. And I think one of the challenges for any community is basically to present a governance model that ensures the viability of the underlying community.
Mm-hmm. We got a question here?
Yeah, so is it okay for me to ask each of them a question?
Sure.
Hey, thank you. I guess first question is for Mitchell. One of the things that has actually caused the rise in popularity of Ajax is that a lot of functionality that was once tied only to Internet Explorer is now actually available in Firefox, primarily XML HTTP requests and DHTML. Is there any thinking on the side of Firefox developer or developers or development team about making sure ensuring that if similar developments show up in Internet Explorer, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 or 10, that Firefox will be compatible with them?
Well, we think about the relationship of IE to the market and to Firefox constantly. So there's two sides of that. One, will we blindly do whatever IE does? No. Right? We took a lot of heat for not copying ActiveX. Turns out, some years later, when the problems with ActiveX become widely apparent, it's a good thing we didn't copy it. But in terms of compatibility, we took a lot of heat for that. And we, you know, more than a lot, let's just say a lot, right? Obviously, it turned out to be a good decision, right? So there are some paths which we won't follow. In general, and to continue to just follow what odd things might happen is overall a mistake. So no, we won't blindly try to copy whatever it is that IE does. Is it, as I said earlier, do we recognize that a significant vast portion of the market still has IE and some level of feature compatibility is important? Absolutely. And will we continue to look at that? And of course.
And my question for Jonathan is, when you first came up there, you kind of dismissed the idea of a web-based office suite. Why?
I'm not dismissing the idea of a web-based office suite. Let me be really clear about this. There's no one hammer for all nails. And it's very unlikely, for example, anyone's going to implement Adobe Photoshop in Ajax. There's no point. I mean, Photoshop and GIMP are wonderful products. Just re-implementing them in something wouldn't make a lot of sense. So,
yeah, Ray Ozzie said that same example last night.
Oh,
so,
you good.
Know, it's kind of like clearly...
We're highly aligned.
You are
speaking for Microsoft.
little did you know. So the other is there are certain applications which are beautifully implemented in DHTML. Go look at Gmail or Google Maps. They're beautiful. They're really well done. But Google Earth isn't done in Ajax. Could it be? Should it be? Maybe. Are you going to write your PhD thesis in Ajax? I'm not sure what we'd be solving. I think, you know, to the same extent, would we re-implement Firefox in Ajax? Why? Firefox exists. So I think there's certainly a set of applications. Look, authoring my blog... You know, I'd like to do that in Ajax, thank you very much. It's just a much nicer environment to do that kind of thing, you know, much more transactional and episodic rather than, you know, long, detached, I'm going to be disconnected, I'm going to be, you know, somewhere where there may not be a network connection. So the most important message is there's no one hammer for all nails. There's no one technology that solves all problems known to man. Let's use the technologies for where it's appropriate to go create the next generation opportunities. But the fact that we've downloaded 50 million copies of OpenOffice in the world, and the fact that, by the way, we tried implementing, you know, a spreadsheet through a portal, there was just kind of no point at the scale that we'd need to implement it if we wanted to serve the broadest market.
Thank you.
You bet.
By the way, I have a real quick question. There's some really interesting analogies between Netscape and OpenOffice in that both started as proprietary software products that then were open sourced. And are there any lessons that you have learned from, you know, the original demise of Netscape and how long it took to get it right with Firefox?
Everything Sun does will be open sourced. Everything. Yeah. Now, we may have to use different licenses just based on the issues we face in the marketplace. But I guess the message I would give to software companies specifically is get to open source quickly. There is no downside that I can see. By the way, get to free quickly. There is no downside I can see. Because by the value may have to come from something else, yeah. As I think Mitchell points out, and as we certainly have pointed out, but there's immense value in being able to reach the broadest market in the world. And then, you know, once you've got that community and that volume, try to figure out what are the responsible ways to go create value for your shareholders.
The latest version of Solaris has a lot of really great new features like the dtrace and the ZFS, which hopefully will show up soon. To what extent do this great new engineering, does it feed off of open source or vice versa? Are the engineers more inspired because they get to release it? How do they work together?
So a couple interesting things. One, dtrace is now being implemented in FreeBSD, which we're supporting as aggressively as we can. But there are 1,000 Sun employees that are a part of the Open Solaris community, 1,000. There are 7,900 non-Sun employees in the Open Solaris community. I love that. And are the Solaris developers feeling like they're responsible for everything? No, it's now being disseminated. There's an Open Solaris governance process, which is, you know, leveraging off of what we did with the JCP to be inclusive. And yeah, they're getting a lot of heat right now because they're having to learn how they're not going to be in control of everything. And I think that's something both of us have had to figure out. That's a good thing, because guess what? Innovation happens elsewhere. Someone clever once said that. Assume that and now figure out how to take advantage of it.
So it seems like there's a paradox at the heart of Web 2.0 that, you know, the Web 1.0 or Capitalism 1.0, hi Tim, it's Ernie, is that we are trying to, you know, the old paradigm was we try to maintain control, try to dominate the market, try to lock up the IP, and now I hear everyone saying, okay, the goal is to give up control, the goal is to give away everything for free. And that does seem to be a fairly robust paradigm, at least to first order, but the second order is how do you actually make that sustainable?
So I think the first, as Mitchell was saying, the first wave of the internet was all about you're going to pay me for my IP before I deliver it to you. And all that did was really, you know, stultify the marketplace. I mean, imagine if we said to download Solaris, you needed to pay us $100 first. That's what we used to do. It didn't work all that well. Now that it's free, there's 3 million licenses floating out there. That's a good thing. The second thing it forces you to do, though, is figure out, are you going to make money just based on the service that you're delivering, you know, on getting the stuff that we can give to you, or are you going to figure out, and to me the most interesting thing about Web 2.0 is now the technology is resident in front of you, and not, by the way, exclusively delivered through a browser. iTunes isn't delivered through a browser. You know, there's lots of wonderful technology. Google Earth isn't delivered through a browser. There's lots of interesting service opportunities that are emerging. I think, to me, the most interesting thing about Web 2.0 is it's all about let's distribute the technology, not simply the service, and now figure out how to monetize it. And so do I think there's any, you know, great shift that's going to occur at some point in the future around the durability of an economic model in Web 2.0? I'm not worried about it. You know, the network is connecting to all products and all devices. There's going to be plenty of monetization opportunities there. I don't think the old world of you're going to pay me for my IP before I give it to you is, you know, in any danger of coming back.
I want to just hit you up with a follow-up question, though, there. It's pretty clear. I mean, I think we all agree that there's huge revenue opportunities in this new world. The question is, are they equally accessible to all companies? And what is the transition for, you know, a company that's made its money in the old world to making its money in the new world? You know, a good example of this, if you look back at the last major transition in our industry from, you know, the mainframe mini computer kind of model to the PC world. I mean, IBM went through a world of hurt before they reemerged, streamlined, and a competitor in the new world. Now, I believe that Sun can make that transition, but do you have some pain ahead of you?
The past 4 years, what do you think has been a walk in the park? So look, there's a few things that I think will be true 5 years from now as much as they are today. In fact, I had a really interesting dinner with the CTO of a big media company recently, and we were talking about DRM. And he said, well, one of the assumptions we make in our network, well, we should talk about that. You know, GPL requires some level of DRM, you should notice. It was interesting. He was saying most of the content that we sell to the world has already been pirated and copied, you know, because we're basically selling movies that are 15 years old. And they make a fortune off of this. Yeah. And so my belief will be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, content will still be immensely valuable. It's not going to lose its relevance or its value. I think the traditional software marketplace is going to converge with the media marketplace. Just look at Blu-ray and HD DVD, and you'll get a sense for the convergence of programming in the content sense and programming in the software development sense. And that as that happens, there's going to be more and more value. Now, for Sun, or somebody who's trying to monetize the sale of technology exclusively, I think if you don't have intellectual property, you are going to be in a world of hurt. If what you're trying to do, and let me cite maybe Dell in this instance, is make money off of other people's IP by distributing it, I think that's a tough row to hoe against Walmart and Walmart's successors. If what you're doing is delivering unique IP and unique value and unique competitive advantage, I think there's a massive global market that hasn't even opened up in front of us. It's just not going to be accessed through traditional means.
Any concluding thoughts, Mitchell?
Well, as to your particular question, in the long run, I assume there'll be some shakeup of who are the big players now and who are they in 5 or 10 years from now. I mean, to think that technology is going to change and everything else is going to go along the same just seems unreasonable. But maybe that's easier for me to say since I'm in this small little place and I'm not, you know.
And not a commercial player, so you've got no big stake to protect.
Why
right. Well, I think to say that
she's not a commercial player?
Let's go there.
Well, you're incorporated for a reason, right?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, incorporated at all, or so we have a thought. We have a nonprofit parent, and we have a taxable subsidiary.
And the taxable subsidiary exists to make money.
The taxable subsidiary exists not just to make money, but because Firefox has value, and you can't deal with that without being in a taxable setting.
So just to help people interpret that, right. It's a for-profit business. That's a good thing.
Wait a minute. It has elements of that, but it exists to serve it's owned by the parent, right?
You're not a philanthropy, and we're not a philanthropy. We all have a common objective, though, which is to grow the broadest community and the broadest market. But at the end of the day, we also want to create a viable economic model so that more people can, you know, participate. At the end of the day, it's about creating opportunities for people, and a lot of those opportunities are economic. We shouldn't be ashamed of that.
Well, I'm not ashamed of that, but we are slightly different, right? We are not about revenue maximization and only the return on investment. We are not.
Now, you're speaking as the for-profit company or the...
Yes, I am. We are owned by his parent.
I think what we're demonstrating is why Jonathan's the right man for Sun at this point. He's going to make sure that Sun has the last word. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by Mate Magazine, technology on your time. You've been listening to a conversation Tim O'Reilly had with Mozilla Foundation President Mitchell Baker and Sun President and COO Jonathan Schwartz at the Web 2.0 conference in San Francisco in October 2005.